of the Legislative Audit Commission, today being April 20th, 2018. I'm glad to have you here, Ms. Randall, before the Audit Commission, and the only item on the agenda today is the release of the OLA evaluation of the Board of Animal Health's oversight of deer and elk farms. So with that, Ms. Randall, go ahead and start your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. Madam Chair, before we do get into this evaluation, I just wanted to remind the Commission that we have one more evaluation we plan to release from this past year's cycle, and that will be our evaluation on early childhood programs, which we will be releasing next Thursday morning.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. With that, now we will turn to our evaluation on the Board of Animal Health's oversight of deer and elk farms. As you know, the Board of Animal Health is responsible for protecting the health of the state's domestic animals. This includes cattle, swine, sheep and goats, horses, dogs and cats, poultry, and deer and elk. Our evaluation focused specifically on the board's actions regarding farmed deer and elk, which collectively are referred to as cervids. Much of the oversight the board provides of cervids relates to the state's interest in controlling chronic wasting disease, also known as CWD. As many of you know, CWD is an always fatal and highly contagious disease found in cervids. Unfortunately, the disease is not well understood, and it cannot be reliably detected until the deer or elk has already died. Understandably, CWD has caused great concern among cervid producers and also among hunters. The disease has been found in Minnesota in farmed deer and elk, as well as in wild deer. As Ms. Dela Cueva will tell you, we had some concerns about the oversight the board provides of cervid producers. For example, we found that the board has not ensured that deer and elk producers submit tissue samples as required for CWD testing of all deceased animals. And in fact, we found that in recent years, about one-third of producers did not submit required tissue samples for all deceased animals. This is concerning because these samples are critical for identifying and then subsequently controlling CWD in our state. To talk more about this finding and other findings and our recommendations, I would like to now turn to the manager of our evaluation, Sarah Dela Cueva. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Randall and Ms. Dela Cueva. Glad to have you here. For the audio record, again, restate your name.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Sarah Dela Cueva, and I'm from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I'm pleased to be here today to discuss our evaluation of the Board of Animal Health's oversight of deer and elk farms with you. A key finding from our report is that the Board of Animal Health has historically struggled to enforce certain laws related to deer and elk ownership. We observed, however, that the board over the past year has made considerable efforts to improve its enforcement. Nevertheless, we make a broad recommendation that the board continue to improve these enforcement efforts and apply consequences when necessary. That's a pretty broad recommendation, though. We're going to focus in on some of these specific findings and recommendations for this presentation. We suggest that the board clarify its requirements related to animal inventories. We suggest that the board systematically analyze chronic wasting disease testing results, as Ms. Randall already spoke to a little bit. And also, we're going to recommend that the board and the Department of Natural Resources have a memorandum of understanding in order to facilitate its data sharing. At the end of my presentation, I'm going to talk a little bit about a couple of recommendations for the legislature. We suggest that the board consider modifying the composition of the board. And also, we think that the legislature should establish an advisory task force that looks at certain issues related to deer and elk policy. Before I dive in, I'd like to share a little bit of background information with you regarding the Board of Animal Health and deer and elk in Minnesota in general, farms, deer, and elk. The board has 5 members, but its work is mainly carried out by 41 staff, and this consists of office staff as well as 13 field staff who are located around the state. The board also receives support from the United States Department of Agriculture, which employs 13 field staff who also undertake board duties, including deer and elk inspections. In fiscal year 2017, the board spent about 9% of its budget on its deer and elk oversight. This came to about a little bit more than half a million. And as of earlier this month, there were 398 registered herds in Minnesota. And on those farms, there were 9,300 deer, elk, and other similar species. If you turn to page 5 of our report, you will see a map. This is Exhibit 1.1, and that shows the Minnesota counties where deer and elk farms are located and roughly how many deer and elk farms are in each county. I also think it's important to give you a bit of background information about chronic wasting disease, also known as CWD. The recommendations in this presentation are mostly going to tie back in some way to chronic wasting disease response or prevention. CWD is a major threat to the health of both wild and farmed deer and elk. It is always fatal, and it's a neurodegenerative disease that causes loss of body condition as well as disorientation, among other symptoms. CWD has been found in 25 states, including Minnesota, where it's been found on 8 farms since 2002, as well as in the wild in 2 counties. And in Chapter 3 of our report, there's a couple of exhibits that you might want to take a look at. Page 36 has our map of the United States with where chronic wasting disease has been found. And page 40 has a timeline showing the chronology of chronic wasting disease discovery in the state of Minnesota. CWD is difficult to manage for another number of reasons. First, it's hard to identify because infected animals may not show clinical signs for more than a year after they've contracted the disease. Yet, a CWD-positive deer or elk can spread the infection while it still appears healthy. As Ms. Randall said, it can only be reliably diagnosed by testing specific tissues from a dead deer or elk. This makes it very hard for us to identify where chronic disease is. Another problem is that chronic wasting disease is not only transmitted directly from animal to animal, but it can also be transmitted indirectly through environmental contamination. And CWD has been shown to persist in the environment for 2 years and longer. So, taking a look at our findings and recommendations, the first concern I want to discuss has to do with animal inventories. Minnesota statutes require that deer and elk producers submit to the board an annual inventory certified by an accredited veterinarian. these inventories must include every deer and elk on the farm, including their identification numbers and their species, gender, and age. Maintaining an accurate inventory is important because when the board identifies chronic wasting disease on a farm, it has to investigate that farm and the animals on the farm and all the farms that those animals have moved to and so on. And so the inventory is an important piece of that investigation puzzle, and we are hoping that it's accurate. State law, however, does not require that we read identification tags as a way to conduct that inventory. When I first read the statute, I thought that obviously the way to conduct an inventory was to read every tag and then we know which animals are on the farm. I learned that this is not necessarily how it's done. There's no explicit requirement in law that producers, veterinarians, or board staff read those tags. Instead, a producer could construct an inventory by using last year's list of animals and adding the 3 animals that they know were new to the herd and removing those 4 animals that they know died or moved to another herd. At first, I thought, well, that doesn't really seem like enough. That's not verifying which animals are on the farm. However, through this project, I've also gained an appreciation of how difficult it is to read tags to construct an inventory. I accompanied board field staff on a couple of farm visits, and on one occasion, we spent an hour looking at different pens trying to just count how many deer were on the farm. And this was for a herd of 16 animals. I can only imagine how difficult it would be for a herd of 100 animals or more. For many herds, in order to read tags, the animals must be tranquilized or run through a processing facility where they're penned individually and restrained, and either option is pretty stressful on the deer. Nevertheless, we think it's important that accurate inventories are maintained by the herds, and we think that the board should clarify its expectations about whether the producers must read tags in order to construct the inventories. Presently, producers that sell animals to farms in other states must read their tags every 3 years to meet federal requirements, and we think that the board should decide whether to apply this standard to all Minnesota herds or a more rigorous one. Moving on to another issue, as I mentioned earlier, chronic wasting disease is diagnosed by testing dead deer and elk. You have to analyze specific tissues from the obex, the brainstem, and specific lymph nodes from the head. Minnesota rules require that producers test all deer and elk that die at age 1 year or older. But we found that the Board of Animal Health has not systematically analyzed producer compliance with CWD testing requirements. We did our own analysis of some board data and found that many deer and elk producers have not submitted all of the testing samples required by law. We estimated that about two-thirds of producers in the years 2014 to 2017 were fully compliant. They submitted all of the samples that for dead deer and elk that they reported dead to the board. The peach-colored bars here on this slide show that 15 to 24% of the producers during this time submitted some samples, but not samples for every dead deer or elk that they reported. This could indicate a single lapse or a more serious compliance problem given the producer. Our real concern, however, is with the producers in this dark orange bar. These 12 to 16% of producers reported at least one deer or elk dead, but did not submit any testing samples for that year. Therefore, these herds were not monitored for chronic wasting disease during that time that they failed to submit the samples. I would like to point out that this analysis had limitations. The board's data for this time period did not include animal identification numbers for the testing results. They only included numbers of animals tested per producer. So I wasn't able to make a one-to-one match between dead animals and tested animals. The board does have this information in paper records, and they have done deep dives into producer records when they have a reason to believe that there is a problem. But we believe that the board needs to come up with a way to systematically analyze these producers and figure out which producers are having compliance problems in this area. We've been told that the board is working on such a report, and we know that as of July 2017, they are putting animal identification numbers in their database along with the chronic wasting disease testing results, which will help construct that report in the future. Once the board has identified producers that are failing to submit samples, we believe that the board should penalize them appropriately. Shifting gears a little bit, I want to talk about the relationship between the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Natural Resources. Responsibility for deer and elk in Minnesota is divided at the fence. The board oversees farmed deer and elk, while the Department of Natural Resources manages the wild herd. The two agencies must share information in order to respond to chronic wasting disease. Wild deer and farmed deer can come in contact, either through the fence or in the event that a farmed deer escapes. So it's important when chronic wasting disease is discovered in either venue for both agencies to be prepared to respond to stop the spread of the disease. We and others have noticed, however, that the relationship between the two agencies is fairly tense. We're concerned that poor communication between the two could compromise their ability to respond to chronic wasting disease in Minnesota. In particular, both agencies have complained about data sharing issues. The board and DNR must share data. At a minimum, both agencies need to know precisely where an animal infected with chronic wasting disease was found so that they can initiate both of their respective responses. The board has complained that DNR has complained that the board takes too long to respond to data requests related to deer and elk farms. The board, for its part, alleges that the Department of Natural Resources has failed to protect not public data. Producer contact information and identities are protected as not public under Minnesota law. We recommend that the board and DNR enter into a memorandum of understanding to improve data sharing between the two agencies. They're already working on this recommendation. Last week, they signed a data sharing agreement established how they should be protecting not public data. We think that this is a good first step, and we encourage them to continue working together, specifically to establish expectations about data sharing specific to deer and elk. For example, when chronic wasting disease is found, what type of information should be transmitted from one agency to the other and on what time frame? All right, I will now move on to our recommendations to the legislature. The first has to do with the composition of the Board of Animal Health. As I mentioned previously, the board has 5 members. This, however, is smaller than similar agencies we found in other states. 5 other states give deer and elk management responsibility to an agency similar to the Board of Animal Health. And you can see on, that's page 13 of our report, Exhibit 2.1 shows those states and their compositions. And you'll see there that those states have between 7 and 16 members on their boards. We also examined other Minnesota boards that license or permit entities or people, and we found that the board is smaller than almost all of those. Those tend to have 7 or more members as well. Further, we found that the Board of Animal Health is different from other Minnesota boards in that it does not have a seat for a member of the general public. So we recommend that the legislature consider expanding the Board of Animal Health and adding a public member. We think that 7 members would be an appropriate number given the size of other boards of animal health in other states and the size of other Minnesota boards. And the legislature could look to other states when determining the composition. That Exhibit 2.1 shows that other states include in their boards of animal health representatives from related industries such as meatpacking. Some include representatives from specific academic programs like their veterinary school in the state, and others include commissioners from other agencies. I would now like to tell you a little bit about an analysis that I did comparing Minnesota's farmed deer and elk regulations to those from states across the nation. We did our analysis using a very helpful survey conducted by the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, and we found that some of Minnesota's deer and elk policies are quite rigorous. They're in the most rigorous level that the other states had, and those are baiting, whole carcass import, and chronic wasting disease testing. There are some areas, however, where Minnesota's policies are less rigorous. In the areas of deer feeding and the importation of live deer and elk, Minnesota's policies may do less to protect Minnesota's deer and elk than the policies adopted by some other states. And I'll tell you a little bit more about those 2 issues now. Feeding of deer and other similar species encourages animals to congregate artificially, which can increase the chances for disease transmission. Deer feeding is under DNR's jurisdiction, and currently DNR bans deer feeding. They have the authority to ban deer feeding in response to disease outbreaks. So currently, their feeding has been banned in 16 counties across Minnesota. About a third of states, like Minnesota, banned deer feeding only in certain parts of the state. There are 18% of states, however, who ban deer feeding statewide. Importing animals from other states is another way that CWD could possibly spread. As we mentioned earlier, deer do not necessarily show symptoms of CWD when they're infected, and so there's no guarantee that any new animal arriving on a farm is disease-free. The Board of Animal Health permits new arrivals to the state, all animals, and they do issue those permits and will refuse permits to animals coming from CWD-infected farms in other states, and from farms located in CWD endemic areas, which the board defines as counties and other states where CWD has been found in the wild. Almost a quarter of other states have a similar policy where they've designated certain areas as CWD endemic and will not allow imports from those areas. However, half of the states have more rigorous policies. 10%.
Excuse me, Ms. Delacueva.
Yes, of course.
We have a question on this point. Mm-hmm. If you could just do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Delacueva. So when you're saying the importation is only where there's a county where the detection is in the wild deer, what if there is a county where there's a detection in a captive deer farm in another state?
Ms. Delacueva.
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen. Yes, I will be happy to clarify. When there's a detection in farmed deer, the board will deny a permit from that farm in particular, but not from other farms in that county. the county is only deemed endemic when the county has, when a wild deer has been found in the county.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Looking at sort of what the other states do, so there are 10% of states that will ban, that allow imports of deer and elk, but will ban them from entire states where chronic wasting disease has been found. And what was very surprising to me was this really big number, 40% of states do not allow any live cervid imports. So no deer and elk imports for 40% of the U.S. states. All right. Well, given that Minnesota's policies with respect to deer and elk feeding and live animal imports are less rigorous than those of some other states, we felt that they merit a closer look by the legislature. We recommend that the legislature establish an advisory task force to examine these issues. We think you should bring together some diverse perspectives and decide whether our policies are appropriate or whether we should be changing them to be a little bit more protective of deer and elk.
Thank you very much, Ms.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. De La Cueva. I appreciate that. Never thought there was so much to learn about our Minnesota industry that when we focus on it like this, so it's very interesting and appreciate your clarity of presentation. With that, we will go to members. Are there any? Yes. Okay, Ms. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions that come to mind. One is you were talking about tagging, and what I instantly thought of, did you evaluate if chips are used in other states? There's so much technology out there. It sounded like the hassle was trying to round them up and tranquilize them, and I just was wondering why aren't they chipped right away and you can electronically know where your herd is and which ones are where.
Ms. De La Cueva.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bernardi, for the question. I did not analyze that systematically by states. I didn't have a good source of information for that. I do know, I've looked into it a little bit, and I know that the technology for tagging, well, I have to say, I do not know that much about the different types of technology. As I understand it, there are RFID tags that will allow an animal to be barcoded and scanned from some number of feet, but I don't know what the range is in particular, and that this may be something that would be helpful for producers to conduct those inventories. I get the impression that that technology in tags that are appropriate for deer is perhaps new and developing, and I think that maybe the board could speak more to that because they did mention something about that in their response letter to the report. So I will say that I don't know the answer exactly, but that hopefully the board will be able to tell us a little more.
Okay, so
thank you, Ms. De La Cueva.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you. So thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know how it works after there's new, like, questions or new comments made after a legislative audit report would be done, but it seems to me like that would be a recommendation just to look into what kind of technologies exist and how it could help with it doing inventory. My second question is regarding fencing. Did you do any analysis on are these animals staying within the fence, or any getting out of the fence, the double fencing, is that happening in other states and not in Minnesota? I have questions regarding that.
Ms. De La Cueva.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Yes, unfortunately, that was an area where I wasn't able to do a thorough analysis. I've done some, you know, casual searching, just internet searching of trying to find other states' policies, and I've been unable to find any states that have fencing requirements for double fencing or electric fencing or anything of the sort. I know that Michigan this session had a bill requiring double fencing, but I do not believe that it is, it hasn't made it through the process yet. Yes.
Thank you, Ms. De La Cueva. Representative Bernardi, I think we would be better, some of those questions, the Board of Animal Health is going to come up.
Okay.
And so when they present the report, it's what they have done.
Okay, gotcha.
And I think if we can get the Board of Animal Health up here. Representative Hanson, you want one? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. De La Cueva, I want to go back to kind of your beginning here on the numbers, because earlier I think we had been seeing that there were about 420 farms, and you're saying there's 398. And maybe you explain how many actual farms there are. And then follow-up, Madam Chair, is that also, how many actual deer are there? Because if we, deer or elk, because it seems if we don't tag them immediately and we don't track them immediately, we really have, we being here, the state of Minnesota, have no idea of how many animals there actually are.
Ms. Dela Cueva.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen. Yes, the current number as of April 5th was 398 registered herds. Those herds are spread among, some of them are spread among multiple locations, so I believe there's 423 farms where those herds reside. This number, we were working with the number 420 for a little while, but found in sort of a late pull of the data that there were some farms that had originally been had been closed out but hadn't been reflected in the data that I received first. So that's where we originally thought that there were 420, and then that number shrunk a little bit. As for the number of animals, it's a little bit, the number of animals on, according to animal inventories, is about 9,300, and that is, I think, probably about 5,000 white-tailed deer, a little more than 3,000 elk, and then several other species make up the balance. And as you mentioned, you know, we don't necessarily track new fawns as soon as they're born. The law allows producers to tag those animals by December 31st of the year that they are born. So it's true that at any given time we don't know how many fawns are in existence in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Dela Cueva. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to be clear, a fawn could be born in May and not have to be tagged until December 31st. So if it escaped, we would have no idea.
Ms. Dela Cueva?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that is correct.
Okay, with that, members, let's have, thank you, Ms. Dela Cueva, Ms. Randall, appreciate your presentation and your time. And with that, with the Board of Animal Health, Ms. Thompson, Ms. Glaser, and Mr. Compart. All three can come up at the same time. Welcome to the Commission. Glad to have you here today, and to have an opportunity for you to have your say in a very important topic here. Who's going to start?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Thompson. Okay. I am the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and State Veterinarian. And I don't know if you want the other two testifiers to introduce themselves right now.
No, introduce as you're preparing to testify. So who's the first person to present?
I will be.
Okay, all right then. If you just go right ahead then.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Board of Animal Health is the agency charged with protecting the health of the domestic animals in the state of Minnesota. And as previously mentioned, we have approximately 40 employees. The board's work includes surveillance for and response to disease threats. Our list of reportable diseases includes all foreign animal diseases, such as foot and mouth disease, African swine fever, and for those of you who remember, in 2015, the board was the lead agency in responding to highly pathogenic avian influenza. Our other diseases of concern include, and this isn't an inclusive list by any means, but diseases you might be familiar with, anthrax, rabies, brucellosis and tuberculosis, and chronic wasting disease. The audit was an excellent opportunity for the board staff, as the CERVID program involves a high level of regulations as compared to our other animal health programs. This program has been in place since 2002. Overall, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the board concurs with the recommendations and actually has been working on most of them, if not all of them, at this point in time. But what I'd like to do is move down through each of those recommendations. And this is my comments are going to be very brief, and it's in addition to the letter that was submitted with the report. So recommendation number one, the legislature should consider expanding the size of the Board of Animal Health and adding at least one member of the general public. The board concurs with this recommendation and looks forward to legislative input on this recommendation. And please remember, board meetings are public, and we do have citizens that come to our board meetings. Recommendation number two, the Board of Animal Health should update its inventory report form to collect statutorily required information regarding the origin of the deer and elk that are that make up the registered herds. The board concurs with this recommendation, and the modifications to the inventory process and the report form are already in the works. Recommendation number three, the Board of Animal Health should clarify expectations of whether and how often producers must verify their herd inventory on an animal-by-animal basis. The board concurs with this recommendation. And as mentioned, the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, requires owners of herds who move animals interstate between states to verify the animal ID on the inventory every 3 years. Now, there are some herds in Minnesota that only have one or two animals, and those herd owners can easily verify their animals. But as noted in the report on pages, I think it's 23 and 24, are examples, considerable time must be spent to catch cervids and read ear tags. And we do have some examples of ear tags up here for you all if you're interested. Because we do have approximately 400 herds in the state, we believe a three-year rotating schedule to catch and read ear tags for all of the animals, the 9,300 animals, is reasonable and would also be in line with the federal requirement. This is still going to take additional time from what the board already spends on this program. Recommendation number four, the Board of Animal Health should, number one, systematically analyze whether producers submit tissue samples from all deceased deer and elk to test for chronic wasting disease, and number two, appropriately penalize those producers who fail to submit samples. The board concurs with this recommendation. It is unfortunate. Producers don't always immediately recognize that they have a dead animal, and when we are testing the brain, the obex, that sample can degrade fairly rapidly when we have a 90-degree day or if it's frozen in a snowbank. But as to number one, board staff are now requiring that tags be submitted with samples to the veterinary diagnostic lab, and tracking of death reports with sample submission has now been included in our data entry procedures. As to number two, board field staff are being retrained on the use of the violation documents, with the current assistant director maintaining oversight on the violation procedure. And we just had a work conference. We're starting that retraining just a few weeks ago with our field staff. Recommendation number five, the Board of Animal Health should develop an approval program for deer and elk producers who wish to collect their own chronic wasting disease test samples. The board concurs with this recommendation, and in fact, as mentioned in the report, we have a model for this with our poultry testing disease agents. Those people are trained or retrained on a yearly basis for taking samples in poultry, and that was a big help during high path avian influenza to have those folks trained. But please remember, as we move forward with this training idea, we do need dead animals to do the testing and the training. So that is going to be something we're going to have to work on. Recommendation number six, the Board of Animal Health should, number one, fully enforce Minnesota law, number two, strengthen consequences for failure to comply, and number three, develop methods of monitoring field staff performance. The board concurs with this recommendation. As veterinarians, board staff want to educate. But, however, we're also regulatory personnel, and we must enforce Minnesota law. We are addressing increases in penalty amounts, the retraining of staff, as I've already mentioned, and developing reports to track our staff performance. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, I'd like to address both number 7 and 8 together because I think those two fall together. Recommendation number 7, the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Natural Resources should draft a memorandum of understanding outlining each agency's responsibilities with respect to data sharing. And number 8, the Board of Animal Health staff should take greater care to properly label not public data that they distribute to other agencies. The Department of Natural Resources should protect the not public data it receives from other agencies. As mentioned, the board and the Department of Natural Resources have already entered into a data sharing agreement earlier this month, and this is the first step that the two agencies can do while we work together to battle chronic wasting disease. And the board is committed to carrying through with this recommendation. Lastly, recommendation number 9, the legislature should convene an advisory task force to evaluate the state's regulations related to deer feeding and live cervid imports. The board again concurs with this recommendation. Prions affect both wild and farm cervids. The list of risk factors for the movement of prions is long, and both deer feeding and live cervid imports are on that list. We are also wholly in support of further research so that we can make science-based decisions on the risk of these items. So overall, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the board is committed to the protection of animal health in the state of Minnesota. We truly do appreciate the time of the legislative audit, the auditor that was in our office. It was a good experience for us. We've got fairly new leadership at the board with myself and also with the program director for this program, and we are looking forward to making this program in line with the recommendations as made. And with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Thompson. I appreciate your presentation. Are your other two testifiers also prepared to present or to comment?
The other two testifiers are here for specific questions as they may arise. So Dr. Glazer would testify as to any program-specific items, and then Mr. Compart is here as a member of a board maybe to talk about board membership.
Mr. Compart, as chair of the board, want to give you an opportunity to speak on behalf of the board, if you would.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am involved with a family-owned and operated swine breeding stock business in southern Minnesota. I represent a third generation involved in that livelihood. I've grown up in production agriculture, and I've seen an incredible change from when I was a little kid, where we milked cows, we raised pigs, we had sheep, we had chickens. The industry doesn't look like that anymore. You know, that's gone by the wayside. The Board of Animal Health has been in existence since 1903, and I think the earlier comments were made relative to why it was started, and they had good reasons to start it. And the membership to the board is 3 producers and 2 veterinarians, and that's back when it began. Consequently, I think maybe we've not necessarily kept up with the changes in agriculture as we've seen them. You know, the veterinary clinic that we began working with was a very well-known multi-species veterinary clinic that now, as of September of this past year, they've gone strictly small animal. In the meantime, and well before that, and part of the reason that they ended up going strictly small animal is we branched off with a specific clinic that specialized, in our case, swine breeding or swine animal health. And this is what you're seeing happening out here, is it's becoming highly specialized, and it's very important that we recognize that, and I think from the standpoint of representation and expertise, because that's really what the veterinarians bring to this board is an expertise. We as producers bring kind of the grassroots. This is how the perspective from the farm, so to speak, but those are people that the veterinarians that bring and can bring science and more of the animal health side of things. And I think this is something that 3 years ago when the commercial dog and cat breeder bill was introduced or was passed, we took that and were asked to run that program, administer that program. In my opinion, we should have had a small animal veterinarian that was added to the board. What happened was we had a large multi-practice veterinarian that ended up at the end of the term that was replaced with a small animal veterinarian. And I think if something has been in existence at that time for 112 years, and that's where a lot of your expertise can come from, that it should have been handled differently.
Thank you very much, Mr. Compart. I appreciate your comments. Very helpful to hear. I would say that the advisory task force is something that I think would be very helpful legislatively, establishing and doing that. But the work of the advisory task force can help us as legislators know what's the recommendations as far as how large, which members, There's a whole variety of questions that are more details that I think Ms. Dela Cueva, in mentioning the advisory task force, kind of helps you and helps the board and for us both. I have a list of folks who want to ask a question. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Ms. Thompson, does the Board of Animal Health have general rulemaking, or is it that which is requested by the legislature when law is changed?
Madam Chair, Thompson? Yeah, mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, representative, we do not have general rulemaking in certain programs. It depends on the program. We always look to the statute as to whether or not we can go ahead and make rules. However, and I apologize, I didn't bring my rule book with me, there is a statutory reference to the board making rules in line with what's in statute at this point. That's a long way around, but I apologize. I don't have my rule book with me.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson.
Representative Erickson?
Madam Chair, are copies of the rules provided to the owners of our herds?
Ms. Thompson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, representative, yes, and I'm not sure if we do have pamphlets that we just put together that go out to all of our Cervid producers. That Madam Chair has a copy of that right now. In addition to that, there is other information that's passed on to the producers.
And Representative Erickson?
One last question about rules. So when the statute is changed, is it your opinion that then the rule that might be promulgated then is keeping up with the change in statute? Or I think the last time you promulgated rules was in 13, at least according to the report, and I really appreciate that the Office of the Legislative Auditor has referenced both law and both the statute and the rules, because rules are supposed to bring the specificity to the statute, and sometimes that's questionable. Do you think, in your opinion, you've kept up, I guess, because you have the rulemaking?
Ms. Thompson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so first of all, Dr. Glazer has a copy of our rule book. There is a subdivision 13 in the statute that allows the Board of Animal Health to adopt rules as necessary to implement this section to otherwise provide for the control of cervidae diseases. And in my opinion, without talking to the revisor's office, if there are changes to be made to the statute, we then have rulemaking ability. And with some of the recommendations, I think we will be having some rule changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did think they had general rulemaking authority, so thanks for verifying that.
Thank you, Representative Erickson and Ms. Thompson. In regards to rules, though, they are specific to implementing the statute.
Yes.
So there's always a balance between implementing statute and then kind of going off into legislating or adding to that. So if you need to talk to somebody in regards to rulemaking, we can help assist you with that through the legislature's staff. All right? Okay. Next, I have Representative Hansen.
I think Senator Friends was on the list. I would defer to the Senate. No.
On this commission, you're all equal. But with that, Senator Friends.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen. First of all, I just had a question, Mr. Compart, but thanks again. Nice to see a fellow member of the Nicollet County Pork Producers up here in St. Paul. And thanks for your work as board chair. So if we have a recommendation to add a member of the general public, do you mind sharing with us who would be a likely candidate? I don't mean a name of person. What kind of person from the public you think might help? Thank you, Madam
Chair. Mr. Compart.
Madam Chair, Senator Frentz, I struggle with that. There's a lot of this. You have to have a lot of background on disease control, disease transmission. And, you know, you'd have to strategically find people who have maybe it's somebody that might be in the nutrition side of things, maybe a master's, PhD, but somebody like that possibly. But I know I served on a committee where I was with 8 PhD geneticists, and many of those were world-renowned geneticists, and I was the only producer member on that board, and the reason I was there was to keep those people grounded. Mm-hmm. And it did not take long in a lot of these meetings for it to go over my head. And I have a degree from the University of Minnesota Animal Science. But when you start talking about statistics and some of the things that they discuss and talk about and modeling and so forth, it's stuff that I didn't do. But as a person who's been involved in that, I had a keen interest to learn, and you pick up things. But I'd be the first person to tell you that I was not real effective in a lot of the discussions, and just quite honestly had to refrain from much of it because I just didn't have that background. So that I struggle with that. I really think we need to look at the industry and drawing people from the veterinary profession that to that board, and I wouldn't say it's not possible, but it's going to take a very unique person, because if you're going to have to background people and bring them up to speed as a general person, I think you could really slow down things greatly. That would concern me.
Thank you, Mr. Compart. All right, Representative Nelson Hansen. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Compart. I'm thinking back when I was in FFA, and I think at the State Fair, Compart sign had Durox, if I remember right, that were there, and that's getting to be a long time ago now. And when the board is 100 plus years, the challenge I think we have is our state is so much different now. And you mentioned the small animals, and the concern about regulatory capture that can or should members of the public, even though they may not be experts, be involved in making the decisions that affect the public. That the recommendation is to add one person, and that means they could still be outvoted, even though they may operate by consensus. The world is much different than it was back when many of the boards in our state were established, that the boards were established to make sure that is the veterinarian that comes out a good veterinarian? Are they knowledgeable, ethical? And this is that's the way the boards were with insurance, with teachers. Are they competent? Are they ethical? And they weren't designed to look at, are we dealing with highly pathogenic diseases? Are we dealing with a myriad of regulations on healthcare? Are we dealing with a variety of interacting agencies and requirements or threats? And I think the recognition needs to be that the public can handle it, that even if they're not an expert, that having public members on the board makes the outcome better, because they may ask the question that the average Jane or Joe in the state says, well, what does this mean for me? Not what does it mean for the industry? What does it mean for me? Or what does it mean for my family? Or what does it mean for my profession? Or what does it mean for my hobby? And so it requires a change of thinking, whether the board is to serve the industry or to serve the public. And I know that's a hard change, but I'm asking you guys to take the risk of doing something different and looking at things differently to see if there is value of having public participation, not just being in the audience, but being at the table. And I'm finding as I get older, having young people at the table, they may ask things that I've never thought of, because I'm bound by my experience rather than by my thoughts of what could be. And that diversity of thought and diversity of experience may add to a better outcome. So I would ask, and when I look at the response from the Board of Animal Health, it comes from the perspective of what you've been doing, of serving the industry, and the agricultural industry. And I think that that's good, but there's also a larger picture. And I'd like your opinion on that, or Ms. Thompson's too, of what is the purpose going forward? Should we be looking at more diversity on the board? It may slow things down, but it may provide more value, not just on this, but other things as well.
Mr. Compart, would you like to respond first to that?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, I can appreciate, I have a son who's involved in our family business, and to have new energy like we brought back in our generation has been great to have. No question, they can look at things differently. very aggressively at times, and we were kind of needing that. I'm at an age where, you know, I don't want to be pushing, and so I can relate to what you're saying, and I can understand where you're coming from on that, but I think the key is if we could add two people, and one would be an additional veterinarian, and then a person from the public or someone in that capacity, I that's what I would like to see. I guess I wouldn't struggle with that. It's just I think we do need to address. We need to get another person who's going to be a food animal veterinarian to get us back to where we were 3 years ago, quite honestly, because that is where some of that expertise is going to come from. So I wouldn't struggle with that. I respect your position on that, and I would look forward to working with someone.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a follow-up. I know several boards have ex officio members from other agencies, and I'm thinking when there's the interaction or the potential for a disease to leap from livestock to public health, having a health department ex officio member or the role, I know when we've been here, had the hearings on the avian influenza, the role of the University of Minnesota, which we've all funded and support the research, you know, is there a formalized way to have input of having the science at the table? I know they may be in the audience, but having them at the table, maybe not as a voting member, health department, because if my fear is if chronic wasting disease can jump into the human population, we're in a completely different world. And so having health or, you know, maybe even the Mayo Clinic, or it doesn't have to be public, it could be private, sitting there at the table and bringing that expertise in, I think we have the Minnesota way of making things better.
Ms. Thompson, you wanted to weigh in on this, did you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, actually in statute, the commissioners of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Health, the Dean of College of Veterinary Medicine, and the Director of the VDL, the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab of the University of Minnesota, may serve as consultants to the board without vote. And generally, all of those different groups are represented at our board meetings.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. I think that's helpful. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this has been very interesting to me because I really was not familiar with the Board of Animal Health. It's just not an area that I work in. Mm-hmm. But I do work in health and human services quite a bit. And there must be some contagion of ideas going on here. Because I was really going to, the reason I raised my hand was to talk and ask a little bit about this very issue of diseases jumping from animal populations to human. And over the last 100 years, in fact, I think over the last maybe many fewer years than that, we've learned a whole lot more about that very problem. And it's a really serious concern, and I'm sure you're aware of that. But it really does, I think that Representative Hansen is exactly right, that we're in a very different world, not only with regard to technology and how our industry is organized, but with regard to what we understand about disease and perhaps in the way diseases are moving because of climate change, because of industry changes, and because of travel. We know, you know, when we hear about Ebola, for example, Ebola is a much more serious threat to us when it's occurring in Africa than it used to be because of how easy it is for people to travel. And so all of these things are so intertwined. When I have talked to some experts about this, one of the huge concerns, for example, when we talk about overuse of antibiotics, of course, we're worried about that in people, and we're always talking about how we need to make sure that in our medical profession we're not overusing antibiotics, but the real concern is in the animal populations. And so how those things are intertwined is really important. So I wonder if, I think that Representative Hansen is right on in terms of getting people in there who have different expertise, and I appreciate what you just said about there being people who are available at the board meeting. But if we're talking even about a public member, I think that bringing in people who have expertise either in the infectious disease on the human side, or there are people who have that, you know, cross-species expertise who would be, I think, very helpful because, you know, we have a lot of resources in our Department of Health about human health, and I don't know. So here's my question, is what is the, in what ways, other than what Ms. Thompson just said about there being somebody ex officio sitting at the board meetings, how does the Board of Animal Health work with the Department of Health? And what's the interaction there? Because just as a citizen, it's kind of what we're doing here is a little bit illustrative of what Representative Hansen was talking about, because here I am, somebody who doesn't know anything about the work of the board other than what we just heard, and I haven't had a chance to read this yet, and I will. But this kind of, here's the question, you know, how is this going to affect, you know, what are you doing that is interacting with the people that are tasked with protecting the health of the people who live in the state, not just the animals?
Ms. Thompson?
Madam Chair, representative members of the committee, a couple of examples. So the Department of Health does have a public health veterinarian, somebody who sits in that position and also has other folks in her area that work together with us. Good example is rabies. I don't think most people realize, but we do have rabies cases in Minnesota on a fairly frequent basis, and it's not only just in animals, wild or domestic. There's usually a person attached to it somehow, and that's how we find out about it. We have that system in place that we work with Dr. Schiftel and her team with rabies, highly pathogenic avian influenza, and our planning for other foreign animal diseases. She has a place in our incident command structure so that she is tuned into, and avian influenza might be an example of that jump from poultry animals into people. And to your point on antibiotics, I just stepped back from the position, but we have a One Health collaborative in the state. It's really one of a kind that has brought together animal, human, and environmental experts, and I was the chair of the animal portion of that, looking at antibiotics, the use, the risks, and what we can do together as a One Health approach to attack the issue of antibiotics or antibiotic use.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Yes, I have you on my list, Representative Bernardi. In regards to the subject of the board members, though, I would say, Mr. Compart, and to you, Ms. Thompson, as well, that I think hearing the broad scope of your animal health board, yours is very narrow. And the purpose of having more members on your board is to have that value that comes from different perspectives. Okay? And so when you just have one perspective or just two, and you have a much larger duty and responsibility than that. So I think when you talk about maybe one more, I think I would go much further and say you need to be going into another four or five people to be added to this board. And I would say that between now and next legislative session, that for you as a board, to take some input in regards to that and develop that. And I would suggest that you would seek out the chair of the legislative committee in the House and the Senate that has jurisdiction in that particular area and meet with them, talk with them, have a board meeting on this subject so that you all take a look who touches this area, the specific area. But I think that would be serving you very, very well, and not ex officio, but actually on the board with a vote. And don't underestimate your public members. Once they're on the board, if they have enough of an interest to accept that appointment, that means they have an interest, and that's the balance to you. And I think, Mr. Compart, you said it well. Just because you don't have all the lingo, that's not why you're there. That's why they are. You are not there to have all that lingo. You are there for a different purpose, and that is very valuable. So I think I just want to speak to that issue before we go further. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Compart, for serving as the chair of this board. Your expertise is very valuable to our state, so thank you. The question I have is, how is the executive director and the chair of the board selected? And then are there women that serve on the board itself?
Ms. Thompson, would you like to respond to that question?
How are they elected? Yes, I can. So my position, I the executive director, state veterinarian, is rehired on a yearly basis. And then the board members select both a chair and a vice chair also on a yearly basis. At this point in time, we do not have a woman on the board itself. Board staff, though, I think we've reached at least 50% on the veterinarians female.
Thank you very much, Ms. Thompson.
Just a follow-up question.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up question to that. Have women served on the board itself?
Ms. Thompson.
Madam Chair, yes, women have served on the board. And actually, the person that I brought up, the public health veterinarian, she was on the board at one point and was the chair.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. With that, members, we have allowed the Board of Animal Health. Next on our agenda is to have the Department of Natural Resources. And I believe we have the Commissioner, Mr. Landwehr, here. And also the Wildlife Research Manager, Mr. Cornicelli. Commissioner Landwehr, welcome to the commission. We don't get to see often this subject in front of the commission, but we're glad to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and I think it's a good thing that you don't see me often, and I just soon keep it that way.
Thank you very much. And if you would just want to comment on this, the connection with you, and especially in regards to the communication, I understand there's a memo of understanding. But if you could just respond to anything at all that is in the legislative audit report that you would like to comment on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And for the record, Tom Landwehr, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and I appreciate your providing the time for me today to provide some thoughts on this. This is obviously a critically important topic for the Department of Natural Resources. I want to first acknowledge that we appreciate the work of the Office of Legislative Auditor. I think they've done a very thorough job. Identified some very serious concerns for our complete response, Madam Chair, members. There is a letter from the department at the very back of this report I will reiterate some of those points.
Well, Commissioner Landwehr, I want you to know I always jump to the back of the legislative auditor's report to read those comments, and they are very valuable. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I think it's just really impossible to overstate the significance of the wild deer herd to the state of Minnesota. It is the most sought-after game species in the state. We sell more than 500,000 licenses each year to hunters. It provides incalculable value through the days of hunting and the relationships that are formed and the people that get outside and the lifelong memories it creates. It really is a significant part of our heritage. But in addition, it's the foundation of a $500 million industry in Minnesota. That is the industry around hunting, and in particular around deer hunting, big game hunting in Minnesota. And because of this significance, the Department of Natural Resources is very concerned about chronic wasting disease, no matter what the vector, and we've seen what it's done in other states. We don't have to guess what might happen here should it arrive here or when it arrives here. Consequently, we have strong concerns about the management of deer and elk farms, recognizing they're just one of the vectors. Given the potential to expose chronic wasting disease to Minnesota's wild deer herd, the stewardship of which is a key responsibility of the Department of Natural Resources. Our concerns are heightened by the discovery of CWD in 8 deer and elk farms since 2002, including 3 concurrent infections. And our concerns center on the potential for diseased farm deer being brought into the state, effectively importing CWD into the state, escaped farm deer, or transported deer spreading the disease within our borders. We agree with the legislative auditor's recommendation that BAH should enforce the farm-to-deer rules. We are greatly concerned with the finding that in some instances the Board of Animal Health has failed to enforce the state's deer and elk regulations, and concur with the recommendation that that should be a priority. We've got good laws and policies on the books. I know we've got some very conscientious producers as well. But without the enforcement of these laws and policies, they really are meaningless in terms of protecting the wild and the farmed herd, for that matter. Fundamental to this effort is the adequate inspection of facilities, the monitoring of herd inventories, and the enforcement of regulations such as fencing requirements, CWD testing requirements, and the requirements to report escapes. Much of this ends up being self-reporting, and I think that does pose some challenges, but I think diligence on behalf of the BAH to monitor that reporting will be critical. We therefore agree the BAH should use the tools that monitor the inspection process and that there are appropriate penalties for non-compliant producers. Madam Chair, to your point, we agree that we should have a memorandum of understanding. It's sometimes challenging when we have the agency-to-agency relationship that we have, whereas the Department of Natural Resources reports, you know, through a commissioner to the governor, a board, and this is not unique to the BAH, the executive director reports to the board. The board is appointed by the governor, but ostensibly there's a very little connection after the fact there. And so the Commissioner of Agriculture does not have sort of line item authority. So it is important that we have some protocols for operating between the agencies. We have signed a data sharing agreement, which further clarifies roles and responsibilities, but agree with the LLA suggestion that we should be looking at other areas of coordination, something we've done just recently, Madam Chair, members with the Office of School Trust Land, which has a not in a completely different responsibility with respect to other elements of Minnesota's resources. We also agree that DNR should protect the not public data that is that we receive from other agencies. Obviously, we deal with gigabytes of not public data that we protect daily, and I will assert that the challenges we've had in this case have been accidental, not intentional, and we have already taken steps to clean that up. And Madam Chair, members, we also agree that rules for deer feeding and live cervid import need review. We agree that the legislature should consider the finding that regulations relating to deer feeding and live cervid import is not as rigorous as they are in other states and bear review. Our own Deer Management Plan Advisory Committee recently recommended that DNR pursue a statewide deer feeding ban. As part of the implementation, we would seek additional public input on potential plan actions. But, Madam Chair, members, that could require some legislative authority as well. We agree with the OLA that the BH program has improved dramatically in recent months, and credit Dr. Glazer for that. We're hopeful that this will continue. I think I would acknowledge that there is a great imbalance between the resources that the Board of Animal Health has to deal with this issue and the challenges that they've got, in particular with enforcing. When it was mentioned about the challenges, you'll see this in a report about just inspecting deer, doing an inventory. And an inventory to me means you count animals. It doesn't mean you estimate, but it means you count. But the challenges of that in a 40-acre woods with 20 deer that don't necessarily respond the way you would like is very challenging. We acknowledge that. Inspecting fencing every year is challenging. We acknowledge that. And BAH currently expends a disproportionate share of their annual resources on this relative to the many millions of other animals that they are responsible for oversight on. Madam Chair, members, it's our goal to work with the Board of Animal Health to ensure that the chance of CWD spreading in Minnesota to wild deer from farm deer is minimized, and we welcome the opportunity to reset the game and work more closely together. Madam Chair, members, with that, I would stand to take questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Landwehr. One of my questions is, do you... in the wild population, I would suspect you also find chronic wasting disease. And so how does the DNR handle that particular area? Since we kind of had one part of the farming one, what about the wild?
Madam Chair, members, a great question. That's something we've been really intently focused on since it was discovered in the wild in 2002. Right now is a very good example because we are engaged right now in a very, very intensive control effort in southeastern Minnesota. Other states that have not done this, and Wisconsin is notable in this, where they have failed to sort of aggressively respond to the chronic wasting disease in wild herd, are getting to the point where they have chronic wasting disease that is out of control, is incontrollable. And that, as you will see in the report, poses all kinds of challenges because of not just the health to the deer herd, but the potential threats to humans as well. When we find chronic wasting disease in the wild herd, we immediately launch a very intensive harvest program. And I should back up a little bit, Madam Chair and members, and acknowledge that we do monitoring each hunting season. We monitor some portion of the deer herd, in particular those areas where we've had some presence of CWD in the past. We monitor for the presence of that in harvested deer. So right now in southeast Minnesota, based on chronic wasting disease found in wild deer beginning 2 years ago, we have intensified our monitoring effort. We required last year that all harvested deer in certain areas of the state that had chronic wasting disease be assessed. We required that hunters provide tissue samples so we could assess the prevalence of that disease. And we've really worked very hard to reduce the herd in those areas, both by regular harvest, regular hunting season, by additional expanded hunting seasons, and even by sharpshooters that come in and knock that herd back. Reason being that, it gives us a better idea of what the prevalence of CWD is by giving us additional animals to test, but also by reducing the density of deer. And we'll never completely eliminate deer from an area of wild deer. It allows us to reduce the chance for animal-to-animal spread. When the deer numbers are reduced, they don't have that nose-to-nose contact. They don't have that passage of saliva. So our primary goal is to knock that herd back sufficiently such that we eliminate the chance for that spread in the wild herd.
Thank you, Commissioner. I always think that when you have a herd that is fenced in, it's one issue. But for you, it's a huge one because they're out roaming around over a very large area. And so I know that is a big challenge. 500,000 licenses a year. I know a few of them go to our home, so we appreciate that. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I know every state has their fish and wildlife agencies, and you talk with each other and have conferences. To the best of your knowledge, what is the current science with resilience of prions in the environment? Do you know, or what do we know, or what do we not know about prions and the residual effect in the environment?
Madam Chair, members, I'm going to babble briefly while I ask Lou Cornicelli to come up, who can give the more coherent answer. But Madam Chair, members, we know that prions, which are the vector for spreading CWD, are very, very resilient in the environment. We know that they will persist in the environment for multiple years. And Madam Chair, members, Lou Cornicelli from our Section Wildlife can give you much better information on
this. Mr. Cornicelli, before I go to you, I just want to mention, is there somebody else in the audience who, on this subject of the Board of Animal Health report only, that wants to address the commission? If you do, okay, I'm not seeing anybody. All right, thank you very much. Mr. Cornicelli, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, for the record, Lou Cornicelli, I'm the Wildlife Research Manager for the Minnesota DNR. To answer the first part of your question, we do coordinate pretty closely with our neighboring states, but nationally with respect to what's being done, what prevalence rates are, where the disease was discovered. In southeastern Minnesota, we have a deer movement study that just started, and we've already met with staff from Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan to talk about capture protocols and data collection protocols. So we work as closely as we can with other states, given the states' responsibilities for managing their individual species. With respect to prions, the data on wild deer, CWD, the only study that's been done showed 2.2 years for prion persistence, but in scrapie, it's been documented 16 years. So we would likely believe that 2.2 years is probably on the low end. The prion likely persists on the environment as long as scrapie or any of the other TSC agents, if I had heard the question correctly from back there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cornicelli. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a follow-up, it's probably several years ago now when there was the bovine tuberculosis. Could you maybe compare or contrast the response that the agency has done in conjunction with other agencies with CWD to the bovine TB outbreak?
Madam Chair, members, I'm going to turn that one over to Lou as well, who's been
okay, Mr. Cornicelli.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, I was involved in the bovine TB event from 2005 through its conclusion. Yes, we worked very closely with the Board of Animal Health at the time on everything from identifying where the deer feeding ban should be, where the modified accredited zone should be, the surveillance that the department did. We actually helped with a lot of the exclusionary fencing that was built. We didn't have much of a role in the cattle buyouts that occurred, but we worked very closely with the board through and Department of Agriculture on that issue, because as you know, bovine TB has a statewide and national implication. So there was a lot of pressure on all the agencies to respond aggressively, and I think we all did that. You know, bovine TB has been, at least in deer, at undetectable levels since when we quit doing surveillance in 2012 and haven't had a single symptomatic deer show up since. We were all pretty aggressive during that time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cornicelli. That's encouraging to hear, the massive response, and I appreciate that very much. Representative Liebling? I've just come from all kinds of hearings in the Senate, and so I have to consciously think that you're Representative Liebling now. So,
thank you, mm-hmm. Madam Chair. You're doing a great job on that.
I hesitate.
Just
a bit.
A great job. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Commissioner, I don't sit on any committees that you appear in front of, so I don't get a chance to interact with you at all. I just want to kind of say that. But I live in southeast Minnesota. I'm from Rochester. I live on a lot in the city that has deer on it, that deer come through all the time. And I was kind of aware that I'm not supposed to feed them. I don't feed them. But I never understood why I wasn't supposed to feed them. And the fact that I don't know that as a legislator, because I pay a lot more attention to these kinds of things than the ordinary person, but that's not my area of work. But it does give me the thought that if not feeding deer is an important part of the CWD control effort, that the public may not understand that. Now, maybe deer hunters do. Maybe people who pay attention to these things do. But if this is a serious effort to control CWD and having the public not feed the deer is important to that effort, I think we might need to do a better job of getting the word out, not just that you're not supposed to feed them, but why. Because when people understand why, they're much more likely to comply. And, you know, just in my role as an ordinary resident of Rochester, with the deer that come through on my property that I could have been feeding, I did not understand why that was important. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Commissioner, could you add some more information about why shouldn't we feed those deer? We want to see them and love them up a little bit.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And this I will offer is a lot like cats. You know, and people know that you shouldn't let your cat out because it kills birds, but people do that all the time. And people love to feed deer. And it's even when they have the best knowledge and the best of intentions, I think people still love to see deer. They love to feed deer. Some of the deer feeding actually just happens incidentally because you have a bird feeder out there and or a squirrel
yes.
feeder, and
its mm-hmm.
stuff falls on the ground and the deer come. So it's. I agree. We have to absolutely make sure people understand that in your desire to perhaps help animals, you may actually, in fact, not be helping animals. You may be causing some real problems. We don't have knowledge to date of any CWD being spread by feeders in urban areas in particular, but of course we don't, that'd be very challenging to track, but we are now doing feeding bans in those parts of the state where CWD has been found, and trying to educate people that way, but perhaps we should do a better job, as you suggest, just statewide, just letting people know about some of the negative impacts of feeding deer.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Cornicelli, as a wildlife research manager, might you have a comment? And for us, why shouldn't we feed those deer? And how does that affect the disease communication process?
Madam Chair, I'll start with the second question. The reason with respect to whether it's bovine tuberculosis that was just brought up or chronic wasting disease, any of these diseases that spread horizontally, in other words, through infected contact or a contact among infected and non-infected animals, feeding has the tendency to congregate those animals. So what happens if, whether it's a salt or mineral block or a feed or a corn pile or something else, if one infected animal eats off that pile, then you've essentially infected that pile. And so uninfected animals can pick the disease up just by simply feeding on the same corn pile or whatever it is. So that direct or horizontal transmission of disease is a concern regardless of what the disease is. Why you shouldn't feed deer, there's a whole bunch of reasons. You increase deer vehicle collisions in the area where deer are fed. You have a pretty dramatic effect on native vegetation or yard vegetation around the areas that deer are affected or feeding. Oftentimes people, like Commissioner Landwehr said, feel good about feeding deer. They'll often introduce a diet that their very complex stomach can't handle. So you end up actually killing deer because they can't take, it's called grain overload or acidosis. They can't take the that sudden shock of grain in their system. And so they're just, the unnatural congregation of animals lends them to higher predation rates where there are wolves because they're concentrating, you know, deer in yards and other areas. So the pluses for feeding deer are not very many other than feeling good. The negatives are far more impactful. With respect to our feeding ban, as you know, we have authority to ban feeding for disease reasons, and we do that pretty broadly and pretty routinely. So we have taken that very precautionary approach to deer feeding as it relates to disease.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Cornicelli. I have a newfound understanding of why not to, and I would agree that when you understand, you're better able to say, boy, I don't want to be the person that might be in a situation of providing communication of those diseases or transmission. So that is very helpful, and I think that getting that out a little bit more to that detail of why, I think, to the general public will probably help in that compliance. So thank you very much. Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Cornicelli. Is the DNR seeing any evidence of a reduction of number of hunters, deer hunters, in the areas where CWD has been found? That's one question.
Mr. Cornicelli?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, the shorter answer in the short term is yes. Although deer hunter numbers in Minnesota have remained relatively stable between 2000 and 2015-16, we have seen this past deer season, we saw about a 6% reduction in deer hunter numbers in southeastern Minnesota. That would be aberrant in my view. We typically don't have more than 1 or 2% fluctuation down there with hunter numbers, and 6% or so was quite a bit. As you know, Wisconsin has seen about a 7% statewide reduction in deer hunters since the discovery of CWD. So there's no doubt in my mind that as the disease spreads, it will impact hunter numbers, which is, A, it compromises our ability to manage deer, one, but two, it's a big local economic driver where those hunters are, not just the buying licenses piece. So that is our concern, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Cornicelli. Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Cornicelli. So I know there's funding tied to the number of hunters, but I'm a little more concerned about what the impact is in terms of crop depredation. If we have fewer hunters, fewer take, what does that do for farms in the area? What does that do for vehicle collisions? What does that do for insurance? I know you've studied, I think there's some deer management meetings coming up, maybe a few more now. So I understand those meetings are coming. When you're looking at numbers and population, what's the impact in the environment? You mentioned in forestry, but I'm thinking, what's the impact on crops, vehicle collisions, public impact?
Mr. Cornicelli?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, in particular with southeastern Minnesota, we have long been concerned about overabundant deer populations. You know, we set regulations and seasons and bag limits with the expectation that we'll be able to manage populations using those regulatory tools. That doesn't always work, and we've struggled as an agency to incent people to harvest more deer, whether it's through venison donation programs, more liberalized regulations, or in our disease management zone, tags that are issued for the cost of printing $2.50. with a decline in hunter numbers, if you set the economics aside, it's going to be even more problematic to manage deer populations, especially in areas where you don't have severe winter. You know, if you think about the northern forest, when we were trying to reduce deer populations in the early to mid-2000s, we were able to do that from the regulatory perspective, but then you get a couple of severe winters and it amplifies that decline. We don't get that in the southern part of the state generally. So if hunter numbers decline over time, then we will have pretty significant issues with how to manage populations.
Thank you, Mr. Cornicelli. Now, I have a question, though. Earlier this year, we had severe weather cold, and then we had severe weather snow. Which one is more impactful to deer?
Madam Chair, by far snow. We have a winter severity index that uses a combination of snow and temperature, but deer do just fine when it's minus 20. They don't like it, but it's not that horrible. Snow is what gets them because they can't access food. Now, snow this late in the year isn't really that big a deal unless the winter was already severe, which it wasn't. So this snow just kind of annoys us all, but it's not really going to impact deer populations.
Thank you, Mr. Cornicelli. I appreciate having you here to ask that question. And so with that, members, we have concluded our hearing in regards to the Board of Animal Health and the Legislative Audit Commission report. And I would say to the Board of Animal Health, there's a significant amount of work to be done, and I would like you to specifically schedule some time to meet with me. I also chair a state government which has oversight on rulemaking, and also task force, advisory councils, a variety of those as well. And so I would like to be helpful to you and helping to move up to the next era for the Board of Animal Health. With that, members, our business being concluded, we are adjourned.